Well, it's a great privilege and pleasure to have a chance to talk to Sir John Gurdon. May I call you John? Is that?
Yes, do.
John, where and when were you born?
Right, I was born in 1933. Is the sound okay? Or
yes, that's fine.
Yes.
Yep.
In the southern counties, the background, in case it's relevant, is that our family actually goes back a very long way. reliably to 1199, as a matter of fact.
Gosh.
So we have a lineage, and the family was rather well established in Suffolk, in a big house for a few hundred years.
Whereabouts in Suffolk?
That was in a place called Assington, sort of in the Sudbury area. Rather splendid house, very large. But my grandfather, who'd inherited from a few generations back, ran out of money because he really survived by renting out farming land. And the repeal of the Corn Laws meant that the farmers couldn't sell that produce, and so they couldn't pay rent. And my grandfather finally had to sell up in 1894 completely. The family home, and he then took over the two sons, which was my father and my uncle, and my father then worked in India and Burma for a while, and then in due course he his father, my grandfather, said to him, "Will you? I would like you to get married and continue the family, so I will personally pay you a pension." By this time the grandfather had made some money. If you would agree to come back and find a wife and make a family. And so that's what happened. And I was then born when my father had left India, and was brought up in the sort of Surrey-Hampshire border. So that's how I came into existence. The family does go back a long way, and actually there's no evidence of any scientific inclination or interest in the family. Mostly politicians and that kind of thing as they go back.
Tell me something about your father's personality. What sort of person was he?
Right, he was quite retiring in a way, my grandfather even more so. But he was very meticulous, and in his later years he read an enormous amount, absorbed everything he could by reading, and became very good at financial matters, which really re-established the family in a relatively comfortable financial state, because he'd inherited almost nothing. My mother encouraged him to do something when he'd retired from India, so he then took up Braille transcription to transcribe exceedingly heavy going legal textbooks into Braille for the blind as a voluntary thing to do. But they used to ask him to do that because he was so careful at doing it. And so that was a major interest of his. He'd had a rather distinguished war period when he was awarded a DCM for gallantry in the First World War, that was. And then in the Second World War, he was just over age, so he was the air raid chief warden for the village. So he took part in village activities and quite a lot of voluntary work. Both my parents did a lot of that.
But there was no scientific interest particularly on his part?
No, none really at all.
And your mother, what was she like?
She was born of a Yorkshire farming family, was a very go-ahead person who, at an unusual time, decided to take a school teaching job in America, went out there and taught in the school, and then she came back and became married to my father. And then she was always very energetic. She used to run anything that could be run locally, the sort of local activities and the Women Institute and that sort of thing. And was a wonderful person, extremely supportive of anything, you might say. So when I took an interest in insects, which I did at an early age, she would sort of encourage that. But then I had by that time my parents had enough money to send me to a private school called Eton, where I was.
Eton?
Eton, yes.
And, you say called Eton, yes.
Well, that's where it was. I did one term of science, age 15, and I still am amused by the report that the schoolmaster wrote at that point, and I have it actually sitting in my office here, but it said something like, "Gurdon is the worst pupil it has been my lot to teach." And he said, "I have heard there is some talk about Gurdon wanting to be a scientist. This would be a complete, total waste of time, both from his point of view and those whose job it would be to teach him." And so I was immediately told, "Well, you're not a scientist, we'll get you off that." So that was the end of my scientific career at school, after which I was put on to Greek and Latin, which was quite interesting. But my real interest had always been in insects and that sort of thing.
How early was this insect interest? How early was your interest in insects?
Probably from age about 8 onwards. I had an aunt who used to catch me butterflies. And I liked to set them and find out what they were. And then for my leisure reading, when I was in sort of mid-teens, I bought one of these very heavy textbooks of entomology, which I used to enjoy reading and reading about it. And so my kind mother decided that I really was a scientist at heart rather than a classicist. And so she arranged through family connections to get an interview with a professor of zoology in Oxford. Of course, Alistair Hardy, and somehow persuaded him that I should be allowed to switch from classics to zoology if I did an intervening year in a sort of crammers to get through the sort of O-level science. And it was a risk because, one might not have taken the subject, but at any rate, they having paid my school fees, they then ended up having to pay another year of private tuition in biology and science, elementary science, to be allowed to start at Oxford. And that was, again, a piece of luck, because the admissions tutor for the college I went to called Christchurch was a man called Trevor Roper. But he had more important things on his mind, and I remember getting a letter one September saying that they'd considered my application to go to Christchurch, and very pleased to tell me that they could accept me on two conditions. One was that I came into residence almost immediately, 2 weeks' time, and the second was that I did not read the subject in which I had taken the entrance. Later I got to know him personally quite well because I was a fellow of Christchurch, and he said that was embarrassing. He just got the numbers wrong and suddenly found they were short of places, so anyone who'd applied and they hadn't done much about it, they then got hold of them. So I got in through an enormously backdoor arrangement, which would never have been possible at present time. So I was very, very fortunate, and really thanks to one's parents for seeing what one's interests really were and allowing one to sort of recover from a really bad teacher at school.
Can I just go back quite a bit, because I wondered what a preparatory school you've gone to before Eton.
Yes, that was one in the village called, the first one I went to was a curious school called French and Heights. It was co-educational, and I remember then that they, age 8, they did an intelligence test, and I still remember it, where they said, "Draw an orange." So I started with a pen and thinking the orange wouldn't be there if it weren't hanging on something, so I drew the stalk. The woman said, across the road, said, "Stupid boy, stupid boy." I said, "Draw an orange." So I said, and then I never got much further than that. And what she meant was, draw a circle. But anyway, my parents then got a message from the school saying that there were really, really great difficulties, and I think I would need special education because I wasn't able to take a normal education. At which point they changed me to another school, which I must say was an excellent school in the same village called Edgeborough, a small private school, where there were very nice masters and staff, and I sort of survived that quite well.
Which village was this?
This was called Frensham near Farnham in Surrey. Surrey.
Yeah. And were there any teachers in that first school who you remember or had any influence on you?
No, not at the first school. The second school, I remember them very well.
The second?
Personal friends, because they lived in the village and we knew them personally.
And you still remember who they were? Or Do you remember their names?
Yes. The headmaster was Charles Mitchell, the deputy headmaster was Bob Hardy, and the Latin master was Norman Stone. And I remember all of them. And we lived in the village. As career went on, we sort of got to know them socially. Very nice people. Lovely school.
So that took you through to Eton, didn't it?
Yes, that did. Yes.
Apart from insects, did you have any other hobbies or particular interests? Sport
during
or?
During my Eton time, I became very keen on in particular squash as a game, partly because you could play whatever you wanted, and I took to that. So my ambition was to end up doing well. I did actually end up being captain of the school team after a lot of effort. I mean, it was an enormous amount of practice, but I was keen to do that. So I achieved that particular objective there, and I was a keen skier. So I got into the second university team for skiing. But again, I didn't really feel I have any great ability. It was just sort of hard work and practice that sort of got one to a reasonable level. So my main interest at school was squash as a sport, skiing in the holidays, and I also became schoolboy secretary of the Natural History Society, which has sort of got me into science a bit more. But those were my main.
What thing. About music?
You, no, I was never either very keen or remotely suited for it.
But do you like it, or you do listen to it?
Only a little bit. I don't go to, not very arty, I don't go to theatres and spend much time watching other people or listening to other people performing their activities.
Do you have, by the way, do you have brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have a sister, yes.
Younger? Or?
She's younger, just younger than me.
What does she do?
She became a nurse, and then she married a farmer who has a big estate in Lincolnshire, and so they live out there, and I keep up with her very well. Being a sort of, well, of course, lifetime friend, you might say.
So when you got to Christchurch and you were told you could do anything except what you had applied to do,
yes.
Left it rather open to you. What did you decide you'd do?
Well, the idea was to do zoology because I got this interest in insects, and so I went to the crammer, and they said you had to pass the so-called prelim exams in 1 year, and that was tough. So I started getting rid of chemistry, which was really just learning formulae after one term. Then physics was very elementary, and then that left the biology for the summer term, and thank heavens got through those three tests, which then meant I was able to start as an undergraduate after 1 year. So I had, of course, to be given 4 years, not three, but as they were short of customers, that was possible.
So you started in your second year to read zoology?
Yes.
Proper?
Yes, yes.
Who were they? I think you mentioned Hardy, Alistair Hardy.
Alistair Hardy was a wonderful man. He was the head of department and, again, actually became a personal friend. Knew him very well. And it was a remarkable department. They, among the eminent people there was a man called Tinberg. And
oh, yes, Nico Tinberg.
Got a Nobel Prize for animal behaviour. Remarkable.
What sort of man was he?
He was a very pleasant gentleman. We sort of knew him, or don't know, small department, you knew all these people well. So it was rather a boring course, to be frank. So 3 days of the week, we did the animal kingdom.
And the whole of the animal kingdom?
The whole of the animal kingdom, just solidly through it, including paleontology. I mean, in the last year he spent 3 days a week doing paleontology, which was describing bones that had been dug up from somewhere. Romans, paleontology, had to learn every bone. It's really a sort of non-intellectual exercise, just memory thing. So when the time came to, well, I was lucky, I was doing badly as a student, and then I thought there's no way I'm going to get through this exam. So something persuaded me that the only thing to do was to look at all the old exam papers for the last 10 years, which I did, and then classified all the questions, and then would go to each staff member and say, how would you expect me to answer this question? And because I'd noticed that the questions were somewhat similar each year. So that, by amazing piece of luck, got me a good degree, which meant I was able to be a PhD student. And because of my interest in insects, I had gone to the entomology department, Hope department, which is part of zoology. And very fortunately, the professor rejected me as a PhD student. I'd asked if I could become one, but thank heavens he said no. bad record. And then this wonderful man, Michael Fishberg, was the embryology teacher, and I warmed to him, and he then actually offered me a place, believe it or not, in his group to do embryology as a PhD student. So I welcomed that, I must say. And that was probably one of the most important steps in one's career, because he was an extremely wonderful person, and put me onto a rather dull project, which I didn't thrive on for 3 months. And he said, "Well, you might as well try this new thing that's just come out in journals called nuclear transfer." So tried that, and by amazing piece of luck, it looked like it was working. So he then sort of gave me that as a major project, and was immensely supportive. I mean, he would let me do anything I wanted, just try anything you want, and if it works, good luck to you. And so that was an amazing piece of luck. So several times I sort of survived what the sort of fate that should really have overtaken me, like becoming a sort of museum entomologist or something like that, and or not getting into university at all. And it was an amazing piece of luck, but somehow it worked out. And then, thanks to my supervisor, Michael Fishberg, then things took off. Once the once experiments start to work, you really don't have a problem.
So can we just go back to the undergraduate time a little more? Were there any of your friends or age mates who you still remember or influence you?
One who I kept up with all my life and still do, then called Brian Clark, became Professor of Genetics in Nottingham, and Fellow of the Royal Society and so on. So he's done very well, and we're sort of personal friends of his. One other person, the best person in the class, became Professor of Biology in York, or John Curry. And I keep up marginally with him, but really with Brian Clark, who is a co-PhD student. We used to, there were only about three or four of us in that year, so we used to go out most evenings and have a snack somewhere or other. So
Very small.
Very small.
Yes. Were there other things you were doing at university? Did you do any sport or drama or anything?
I went into squash, thinking it would be a sensible thing to do, and it was, except that I don't have the physique to really excel. So I got into the second university team quite well and was tested for the first team in Blooms, but I never really had the stamina to at that level to keep this relentless running. And then when I had 1 year to go, it was either a matter of saying, well, I'll really concentrate hard on getting a blue for squash, or give that up and try and get my work going. So I decided to do the work side, the science side, and luckily that paid off. And then I was in the second university ski team, which sort of, so sport was interesting to me without doubt. But I didn't do music or drama or those sorts of things.
What about politics?
No, I didn't really take any interest in that.
Have you ever since?
Not significantly. One has one's views, but I don't spend time on that at all.
How would you describe yourself politically?
In terms of politics?
Yes.
Well, I suppose everyone calls themselves middle of the road, and I think I probably am. So I'm sort of left of Conservative and right of Labour, somewhere in the middle, and I find myself leaning slightly to one or slightly to the other according to what they're doing. But I suppose in principle I'm rather a...
liberal? Would you describe yourself as a...
I might say hardliner. The sort of thing I very strongly object to is people who don't do any work and just say the state must support me for doing nothing. I feel that's completely wrong, and that people should not be able to be just mollycoddled by the state because they don't feel like doing a job, when people who do a job earn the money, pay taxes and pay for them. So I feel strongly on that kind of front. But that's not really political so much as, I don't know what you call it, but it's a view. Sort of respect for people who really put a lot into their life and contribute, as opposed to those who don't.
And the other thing that often, certainly at school or university, is important to people is religion.
Yes.
Was your family or you?
Yes, we used to be, my father would take us to church, line us up to go to our family to church every Sunday in the morning, and very routine procedure. I support the church. I'm in terms of religious views, I would say I'm actually an agnostic on the grounds of I don't know. There's no scientific proof of one thing or another, so I take that view. But I support the sort of ethics of the Church of England. I'm pretty frantic, I'm pretty strongly anti-Roman Catholic. You can imagine with my field, I disagree strongly with what they do and think that it's completely improper for them to lay down the law. People should decide what they think themselves.
In particular in relation to reproductive technologies?
Yes, so this idea of anti-contraceptive, completely nonsensical to me. And anti-stem cells, another thing. In fact, moving on as it were, I find myself giving sort of lectures or a bit more to theology students from time to time now. This happened because I was, in my college days, I thought the sermons were boring. They would say, we'll take, Corinthians 2, verse such and such, what it meant by it. I didn't see that was very interesting. So I then said to the chaplain, why don't you ask fellows occasionally to give an address or something of anything they like to talk about? And there was no, the letter was not responded to for a year. We then acquired back the Bishop of Coventry, who had been a previous fellow of the college.
Is this at Christchurch or Magdalen?
This is Magdalen, 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 Cambridge. This was, he came, Simon Barrington Ward, and so I mentioned to him, and he said, oh, well, we must do something about that. So then I was asked to, got a letter in due course, saying, well, would you actually happen to like to give an address in chapel? So I chose to do that, and this was, I took as a theme that you should not be prevented from trying to relieve human suffering by your religious views. Rather sort of controversial. But I said, you don't have to believe what I say, just think about it. And the chaplain didn't really like it at all.
Were you a master at this time?
I was, yes, I was.
Master of Magdalen.
And anyway, the outcome was that he then got preferment, as they say in the church, and he's made a canon at Windsor. Surprisingly, I then get a letter from him saying, well, actually, that address you gave was actually quite interesting. would you like to come and give it to our theology students in Windsor Castle? So I thought, yes, that'd be interesting. So I went along, and he was very supportive. And we disagree. I mean, we disagree on a number of things, but nevertheless, he's eminently sensible and says, well, you make your point. And, and so I've been doing this for a while, and these are priests in service who are going for sort of revision classes, as it were, by their bishop. And so I go along and I talk about this same theme, what can we do to relieve suffering, and to what extent are those things that we can do contrary to what Christian or religious person would think. And then at the end I said, well, I've spent the morning talking to you, very interesting, but now I'd like you to vote on these issues. So I put up questions for them and asked them to vote, and the first time round most of them voted against the line that I was taking. But then the chaplain very sensibly said, well, next time we'll have a secret vote, because you don't want the Roman Catholic on your right to see the way you're voting. So we did it again, and then it actually came out in favour of the what I call the scientist view. So I find that very interesting to like doing that, talking to people about the to what extent should religion interfere with what many people would think of as reasonable ways of relieving suffering. And the classic case is cystic fibrosis. Should you be able to get rid of all those embryos that are going to have cystic fibrosis by in vitro fertilization, and so essentially avoid an enormous suffering of people suffering from that disease. So that relates in a way to you asked about religion. Well, it touches on that, though. It's a kind of a curious activity that happens to come my way.
Did you find any contradiction, presumably as master of Magdalen? Is it a master or prisoner?
Yes,
a master.
It called master.
You had to preside, or at least, yes, preside in chapel and
yes,
so on.
Yes, sort of, yes.
Did you find any difficulty in doing that as an agnostic? Or?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that an agnostic is an inappropriate position to take. I mean, you could say you're religious or not, but I basically support what the church does quite strongly, but so I see myself as being practicing Christian, you might say, but the fact that I can't prove what we believe is a good reason to be called agnostic.
Can you disprove what you believe? I mean, those of us, we're flooded with Richard Dawkins nowadays, who you must know.
Yeah. He was a student same time as me.
And recently there's been a series on Darwin in which he quite forcefully attacks anyone and says science has disproved religion. You know, how can you possibly go on, etc. What do you feel about his views on that?
I did listen to a program of his, and the strength of his argument seems to be relates to evolution. And he says when you take the geological record mainly by collecting samples from ground, it fits in very well. Well, that's not proof that fits well, and I don't think you can disprove religion any more than you can prove it, seems to me. So he's rather, I think, making a career out of being rather aggressive in this respect, perhaps sometimes rather too aggressive, but that makes you more popular as a television presenter that way.
You knew him, you said.
Yes, he was a graduate student shortly after I was in the same way. He worked under Tinbergen.
What was he like as a person?
Well, he was a very normal sort of graduate student at that time. He hadn't developed this kind of, at least not to my knowledge, this kind of line that he's now taken. But he does he does interest people in science, and that's very good. And I think he balances the this kind of idea of what is the word for it? The Americans use it all the time.
Fundamentalism? No.
It's something like that. It means essentially that creationism.
Creationism
is the word or used.
Yeah.
It seems to me if you can't prove it, you just take the evidence and choose which one you think is most persuasive. But he does a good job in interesting people in science, though I haven't. I don't actually think that I would agree with his views against religion. He's probably, I think evolution has got a pretty good case for it. So that's what he pushes, and that's good for people to know that.
Coming back to your PhD, what was the central, you said you discovered this new
Well, the
theme.
Central theme of that was, at that time, this is the 1950s, we did not know whether all cells in the body have the same genes, genome, or not. So the idea was that as an egg turns into an animal with different kinds of cells, maybe the cells lose the genes they don't need anymore. So if your brain cells wouldn't have muscle genes or skin genes, and pancreas gene cells would have lost their brain and muscle genes, that was a perfectly plausible idea. And that would be a fundamental principle of how an egg develops into an organism, by losing genes no longer needed except in the germ line. But and the point was to test this by experimental means, and the idea was that you take a cell, a specialized cell, take the nucleus out of that and put it into an egg which has no genes of its own. And if you can produce an individual that way from, shall we say, the nucleus of an intestine cell, then that intestine cell must quite clearly have retained its genes for muscle, bone, brain, and everything else. And that was the key question, which had been, people were aware of the question since the 1890s, but there was no good test for doing it. And then two Americans called Briggs and King discovered that you could, in fact, transplant the nucleus of a cell into an egg, and they did that very successfully, in that the early the nucleus of early embryo cells did very well. You put it into an egg and it made a good, this was all in frogs, made a tadpole. But when they tested it a bit later, they found that as soon as the embryo developed, these nuclei lost the ability to substitute for the egg and sperm. And so they quite correctly reached the conclusion that perhaps, after all, genes were being lost or permanently inactivated. And then, so under my supervisor, we started work on another frog called Xenopus. And the results were roughly the same, but the key point was they were coming out the other way around. That even when you took the nucleus of a specialized cell, you still managed to get normal development. And we eventually had a paper where we showed you get normal fertile adult animals from the nucleus of an intestine cell. And that really convinced me and a fair number of other people at the time that the opposite conclusion to Briggs and King, namely that the genes are not lost, and therefore, hence, that all cells of the body have the same genes, same genome, as we call it. And that's sort of come back into popularity recently with this whole stem cell field, because the argument is that if all cells have the same genes, then in principle you must be able to create one cell from the nucleus of another cell. So if you take a skin cell or bone marrow cell, you can take its nucleus out, send it through an egg and recreate brain or nerve or anything else. And hence you will get to the idea of what we call patient-specific cell replacement, where if I was lacking functional heart cells, you would say, can we take some of your skin, turn them into heart cells, give you your heart cells back, but of your own genetic constitution, so there's no immunorejection. And that's become very fashionable now, thanks to a Japanese man who discovered a much simpler way of making this transition from adults.
Who was the Japanese?
His name is Yamanaka, and he's become very famous, rightly so. But it's kind of popularized the whole field, so the press is pretty well full of, or has been for a few years, on stem cells. But, you know, 10 years ago, no one would have known what a stem cell was. So I'm lucky in that the work that we did had a certain fundamental basis to it, of scientific kind, namely that as development occurs, genes are not lost. Fundamental principle, all cells are the same genes. Suddenly that's become potentially valuable and useful to people for the purposes of cell replacement.
How was it that the Americans had come out with the opposite conclusion?
Well, they, for a good reason, that when they did this experiment with very early embryo cells, it worked. When they took the same cells a day later, it didn't work. And that's true, it just doesn't work very well with that particular species.
Oh, it was the species they were using?
They were using an American frog called Rana pipiens. The wild type frog in America. It just, for reasons we don't understand, it doesn't work very well there, but it, luckily for me, it worked rather well with the frog we use, which is a South African one.
When was all this happening? I mean,
this was in the 1950s. So the first successful experiment I was lucky enough to get came in 1958. And then we kept the animals and published what I suppose was the most important paper at that time in this field, and that was the generation of sexually mature normal adult animals from the nucleus of a specialized cell. That was published in the early 1960s.
1962, was it?
64, I think, but it in that kind of time.
Was there any ethical or religious opposition to what you were doing at that time? People didn't know.
The first response really was not to believe it. And the two Americans who did this work were highly respected, particularly one of them very highly respected and an excellent person who I got to know well. And I would have drawn the same conclusion as he did from his experiments. But there was a natural reluctance for some foreign graduate student to challenge these acknowledged masters of the and pioneers of the technique as to the interpretation of it. So for quite a few years I was sort of people find all sorts of reasons to say your experiments were wrong. And then gradually over time people concluded that they were right.
Wasn't there some point at which, in fact, your account I read, there was a problem and it didn't work at one stage, and then you redid it and it worked better?
Not really. Our experiments always gave very positive results. The key feature of them was, again, thanks to this wonderful supervisor, he found what we call a genetic marker Now, when you do those experiments, you transplant a nucleus into an egg, and you have to be able to show that the embryo or animal you get back carries the genetic marker of the nucleus you put in, rather than the marker of the egg whose own nucleus you hoped you'd removed. Because you might not have successfully removed the egg nucleus, it's a sort of slightly haphazard process, and so you really have to have a genetic marker, and thanks to Fishberg, he had discovered one at exactly the right time, and this was of crucial importance for our work. Made it very hard for people to say it's wrong, because the other alternative, well, it didn't have a genetic marker, so if anyone was wrong, it was more likely the other ones were.
I mean, seeing this and doing it technically must have been very, very demanding, and something that only becomes possible with very good equipment. Were there developments in technology?
Not really. The frog cells are very big, and so you can do this by very primitive methods. We made most of our own equipment to make the pipettes or needles you use, and some of them I still use now, some of these things. And it became more refined. And when the work was transferred to mammals, which took a long time to do, they used more sophisticated means of doing everything. But it actually was not very technically demanding. It was the major problem actually was that the egg was almost completely impenetrable, with a very elastic membrane that meant you put a needle in it, like you would here, and the needle would just push the membrane through the other side, so you actually never got it in.
Yeah.
But that, and thanks to my supervisor having bought a new microscope with an ultraviolet source, it turned out that the ultraviolet light permeabilized the membrane. Piece of good luck. So that solved that problem.
You've done all this when you were very young. I mean, you're only in your 20s still.
Yes. Yes.
And you were already the subject of discussion and so on. You were still at Oxford at this stage?
Yes, I stayed there for quite a long time, gradually moving along the academic scale until I was about 39 years old.
What was your first official appointment after you were a graduate student?
I then became a research fellow at a college, at my college, Christchurch. They appointed me to a junior research sort of lectureship, like a research post.
Yep.
And then they promoted me to a sort of more senior research post, which I retained for the whole of the time I was there, very kindly. That was a very good position. Didn't have much teaching to do, and it was a very favoured position.
Have you done much teaching since? Or?
Well, when I then became officially a member of the teaching staff of the Department of Zoology, so I did do teaching, but not a great deal. I remember that the professor who took over, Alistair Hardy, came from Cambridge actually, a man called John Pringle from here, and he appointed me and said he would like me to start off my job with 24 lectures straight off, and that was very tough. And then the next year he said, well, actually I think we can do with 16. And after a few years later he said, well, actually 8 is enough. By the time I left, I was down to about 4. So I was lucky.
That was no reflection of your lecturing ability.
Probably wasn't, because I attracted a lot of graduate students, but nevertheless, I was grateful for being relieved of it.
Did you like lecturing or enjoy it?
I don't really like undergraduate teaching, no. No. I never, even in Cambridge when I did some, I didn't really like it very much. It was very, I objected in principle to the idea that the students, as you know, fill in a report form. And they can say whatever they want, however rude they want to be, which luckily I was spared the rudest ones, but the worst and very offensive ones, and they don't sign it. They just say sort of sack Dr. X.
Do they? No, they don't do that in my subject.
Do they not?
No.
They should sign them. If they want their title to a view, that's very good, but they should be prepared to say, this is my view and that's my thing, that's fine.
Well, they did this for lectures. We have a kind of comments on the lectures, but not on supervisions.
Oh no, well this was lectures.
Lectures,
I'm talking about.
Oh yes. They usually said my hair was not brushed enough or something,
that's
too brushed.
Mild compared to what else.
But you, by implication, you enjoyed PhD and postgraduate.
Yes, that was a nice time. PhD was a lovely time. nice people and a wonderful supervisor and very pleasant, a lovely department and that sort of thing. And then that one, I went for a postdoc period to California, again thanks to the good advice of my supervisor.
What was that like?
I went to Caltech, which was a very good place, and I got to know a whole lot of the senior professors who were, there's only about one of them left now, who I saw a few months ago, but one got to know them all, so an excellent place to be. But the work I did, I never could make it work. I worked on bacteriophage genetics and I couldn't make them work. So as soon as I'd done that, I went back to embryology. But with a much, having learnt a great deal.
This was the time that Fred Sanger was working on phages, was it, as well?
He was, well, I suppose he was working on phages. I mean, of course, his real contribution was sequencing rather than phages.
But, yeah, sequencing a phage.
There were eminent people there at Caltech who I got to know, and, but I just said that kind of science didn't suit me at all, so I had to get up.
Did that kind of society suit you? I mean, have you ever been tempted to go and teach or research in America?
Well, I was sort of, I didn't have a job when I finished my postdoc period, so I was sent round, and I remember the occasion when I went to, there was an assistant professorship available at Columbia University, so I was interviewed for that, and the head of the department said, well, Dr. Gordon, I'm sorry to say we don't feel we can offer you this assistant professorship, but he said, I would say one thing, when you go back to Caltech, will you tell your supervisor at Caltech, who was only about 2 years older than me, that any time he lifts the phone, we have a full professorship we'd be delighted to give him. So it's about as thumbs down as you can get.
Exactly. But subsequently, over the years, you must have been given tempting offers to go to America.
Yes, up to a point. Not enormously. I think one that was tempting was a job at Stanford, which I would have, if I'd been unable to get a job in this country, which I would have liked, I would have been glad to have gone. I like Stanford a lot, have gone there. But you know, I've been lucky. I had good jobs in this country, and people make sort of vague inquiries, or have done vague inquiries. But unless you show some interest, they don't really pursue it very much.
After, I mean, you got up to the level of a sort of university lectureship at Oxford. And then what happened?
Well, then I got this letter from Max Perutz. almost, you might say, out of the blue, just saying that they had an appointment and would I by any chance be interested in moving to the MRC Molecular Biology Lab in Cambridge. And that was, of course, the ultra-famous lab, as you can imagine, with a kind of spectacular collection of people, so it was an enormously attractive career move for someone who hadn't really learnt any molecular biology. So I kind of came across and talked to him and others, and Max was a wonderful person, very supportive, and so he in the end said, yes, well, we'd decided to offer you the job. And it was a whole set of rooms, and the Oxford people had been good to me, and they'd got me an offer of an MRC unit, which is quite a significant amount of research support, with say 4 or 5 positions. But the head of the department was unable to give me space where I could have a coherent group. So it was tempting, partly for that reason, to move to, and of course of the eminence of this Cambridge lab, to come here. So I accepted the job, and then other people in Oxford, who heads of other departments, who I got to know personally very well, most notably a person called Rodney Porter, who is a wonderful man, got a Nobel Prize for immunology. He did biochemistry, but I knew him personally well, or got to know him. You know, I never really did know my head of department very well. So he then mounted a kind of sort of counter move to say, perhaps after all you shouldn't move and we'll see what we can do. But my head of department stuck to his guns, as he had a right to do, and said, well, this is what I'm offering, take it or leave it. So. But the end result of Rodney Porter's activities, well, I wrote to Max and said, well, I'm afraid, after all, it really is rather difficult. We have a new house in Oxford, our family's in Oxford, so on balance it really wouldn't be very sensible to move. And instead of Max, he could have written back and said, well, you've wasted a lot of my time, damn you, I wish you hadn't. But you've got this charming letter saying, oh, well, it's been a pleasure to meet you. You know, really, if you ever change your mind, do just let me know. But in any case, if we've done something to help you where you are, we're so pleased. What an amazing
sweet.
Quite
quite amazing, I thought. So anyway, the outcome was that when this failed, I then wrote to Max and said, well, after all, actually, I would really rather like to move. You know, so he again said, well, come along and talk about it. And so that happened. I actually then accepted the job and moved into Max's institute. And that was a wonderful place to be. And again, I got to know him very well. Enormous respect for Max Bruce.
What sort of person was he? I mean, can you paint a picture of him?
Yes, he was an amazing person. He was very mild in character. And a good example was that as head of this, it must be the most successful research lab in history, I would say. I think they now had 15 Nobel Prizes or something. That's quite extraordinary. Anyway, he wasn't a director, he was chairman. And he specialised, he would insist on that. So when you wanted to ask your ultimate director or something, you just wait till he was in the coffee queue and say, oh, by the way, I really would like a fraction collector or something, do you think we could do that? And he'd just say, okay, just go and get it. And you didn't make appointments with his secretary, you would just wait till you saw him. Extremely low-key kind of administration. And I think that's why he was able to keep this amazing group of people, when you think about it. I mean, Fred Sanger, Francis Crick, Cesar Mostyn, Aaron Klug. I mean, one after another, they were all kept in his institute for their whole working life, whereas any one of them could have taken an enormously prestigious job anywhere else in the world. But Max somehow kept the whole lot going, and I've never quite understood how he did it. But he did have this extremely mild way of doing things. It was never the director says. It was just, well, tell me what you think, we'll see what we can do. So I attribute that to as a real lesson. And when we, in due course of time, came to start our own institute, we sort of set ourselves up with a chairman, not a director, to sort of try and emulate Max's style.
I think it was from Aaron that I heard he used to, in the aforesaid coffee room or elsewhere, used to just wander around and talk to graduate students.
Absolutely.
And assistant staff and ordinary people.
That's right. He
made
did.
Them feel part of.
Yeah, that's right. It was one of his great things. He'd just come and sit at your table, and at first you thought, what on earth do we say to this ultra eminent person? But in the way, you got to know him eventually, and it was his style. It was quite remarkable, I think.
And I also heard that he was very trusting. I mean, he told, I think, Aaron Klug that after Aaron had got his Nobel Prize, that he hadn't thought that what he was doing was at all possible.
Right.
But he hadn't said anything. He just trusted him to get on with it.
Yes. It's a lovely story that goes in that connection with, I forget whether it was Max told me this or not, but apparently at an early stage the MRC said to Max, I see you have all these people on this list. I see there's a person called Klug. What's that person doing? I see they haven't published anything for 5 years. And Max said, oh, that's all right. He's still thinking.
Well, there are one or two of the others who would be nice to have a pen portrait of, too. Unfortunately, I never had a chance to talk to Cesar Milstein. What was he like?
A wonderful person. Again, I knew him because I was a very keen ice skater. And we used to go out to the Fens, and I would take Max Bruce and Cesar skating. So I got to know him well. And he's a brilliant person, very. I find all these eminent people extremely pleasant and interesting. And
just brilliant.
Yes.
I have had a chance to interview Aaron Klug, and he was talking about his recent work. And I wondered whether you'd come across this zinc finger work.
Yes, I have.
He seems to think it's got a large potential.
Yes, well, we've been sort of doing a bit on the side through Aaron with him and with the company he works with, Sangamo. So that hasn't actually worked out in the way we hoped it would. It doesn't seem to work the way we thought it would, so we've rather discontinued that. But Aaron has this phenomenal memory, you may know. It's quite embarrassing.
I mean, he's likely to, some point, say to me, out of the blue, he'd say, you know, that paper you published in 1962, you said something, and I don't remember what I said, but and he remembers things like that. I don't know how.
Photographic memory.
Yes, staggering memory, yes, yes.
And Fred Sanger? I interviewed him, and he seemed very gentle.
Oh, he is, extremely so, yes. I wrote a thing which was quite amusing. They asked me to write a kind of slightly biographical opening chapter in the annual review of Cell and Developmental Biology, and so I wrote about these various people there. And Fred Sanger, I remember saying that if you met him, if you came to the Institute without knowing who he was, you would undoubtedly take him as a janitor. Because he was extremely low-key, and sort of, you know, you'd ask him a question, he'd look as if he hadn't, couldn't understand the question, because he was thinking of a cleverer answer to it. But very nice man, and he used to, I mean, I befriended him a bit when we went to MRC. He would invite us to belong to, join his research group. We mostly weren't invited to join the kind of cell biology one, but Fred's was a different one, so it warmed to him enormously.
Completely the opposite of another Kingsman, Sidney Brenner.
Yes.
All fireworks and...
Yes, very different.
Brilliant. Is there anything to say about Sidney?
He was undoubtedly too clever for me, so when I would talk to him, I could mostly not understand what he was saying. So and then I concluded that was because he would jump, I think in a very slow sort of step-by-step process, he would jump from here to there, and I couldn't follow that at all. So that I have to say, I don't think I ever really communicated very closely with him. probably about the only one I really didn't.
What about Francis?
Yes, well, he was a member of Churchill College, which I was too, and so I immense admiration for his mind, the way he could, some impossibly complicated thing, he could tell you what the main point of it was. So I liked him and admired him. I wouldn't say I knew him socially anything like as well as Max Perutz. So curious enough, the people that I knew socially and hence in a way scientifically were the ones that weren't particularly close to my own field. So Sidney would have been nearer to me than most other people, but I hardly ever had any scientific conversations with him. Fred Sanger, Cesar Milstein, Hugh Huxley, I knew very well. These people, rather outside my field, were the ones I happened to have warmed to.
You know John Walker?
Yes, yes.
I interviewed him.
Yes, well, he's, of course, yes. Yeah,
he was there too. Yes. I mean, apart from Max's personality, do you have any other clues as to why this was, if you're right, the most successful science laboratory in history?
I don't think I really do. I mean, when you think about it, the people like Sidney and Francis Crick had to share an office for the whole of their time. It's quite ridiculous, really. And everyone had minimal space. But I suspect it was that the concept of a chairman can be more effective than a director. It's hard to do when an institute becomes big. That's very difficult to do. You sort of have to have a group of people who really govern the place. But in some extraordinary way, Max did it in a way that displeased no one, as far as I can see. Well, I mean, minor trivial irritations, but nothing compared to what he achieved. So I don't really know how he achieved that.
Where was it out in its present building at Addenbrookes?
It was when I joined it, yes.
Because it's quite a way out of Cambridge, isn't it?
That's right.
Which means that it's separated off from the colleges.
Yes, that's right.
And it means that people there wouldn't necessarily go in and take a major part in college life.
No, that's true.
It would be... I mean, people often say that one of the strengths of Cambridge is the college system.
Yes.
And bringing people from different disciplines together. But
yes.
Sitting out in the new Addenbrookes site,
yes,
you'd be slightly divorced from college life.
We were. That's true. Max had a college fellowship, and so did Aaron, and Sidney was at King's, and Francis was at Churchill. But it was Richard Keynes who was good enough to arrange for me to be a fellow at Churchill. That made a big difference. I had a college connection, because I rather lacked it coming from Oxford, where I had a strong college connection.
and then Richard Keynes really engineered that. So I became a fellow, a research fellow at Churchill for a long time, like 20 years, and that was a huge benefit, which I've always appreciated. I really thank him for that. It wasn't Francis Crick who could have proposed it, it was actually Richard Keynes.
No, I've interviewed him as well.
Yes, I'm
sure. Did you go into college much?
Yes. I hardly ever for lunch. In fact, I never really lunch in colleges anyway. So dinners I find very pleasant, and it's a wonderful kind of interesting community that you can take a guest to, and it's always interesting. So I really, I feel slightly parasitic, to be truthful, because I don't think I do enough to help the college system, but I really appreciate it a great deal. My Christchurch days were very different there. I remember if you went to High Tabor at Christchurch and knew anything scientific or technological was inappropriate conversation.
Was it?
You should not be allowed to. That's not. You do not talk about that at dinner. Whereas now, I would say most conversations in the colleges I'm involved with is more often than not has some scientific or technical because it's interesting. So it's a big change.
It is. Or is it a change between Oxford and Cambridge?
No, I don't think so, really. I think it's the change in the... I mean,
when you first went to Churchill and so on, could you talk about anything?
Yes,
of course, it was a college that was set up for scientists.
It was, and there was a sort of interest in science. Mm. Yes, that's right. Mm.
I mean, there was a taboo in many colleges for a long time about talking about your own subject, your own...
You mean that you shouldn't?
Yeah, you shouldn't talk about it with a fellow person in your district.
Well, I think there's an element now of, in order to be make it a nice social occasion, it isn't much good to talk to an immediate colleague just about what you're doing.
But
usually, if there's someone nearby, you'd say, we're talking about stem cells or about ethics or something, and you sort of bring them in.
Yeah.
I think that's a socially desirable thing to do, and I would say we still make an effort to do that, even though, as often as not, you're talking about something remotely scientific or technological.
Did you ever feel or have any conversations which were important in your work? I mean, Gabriel describes how he first met Pat, or Pat met Gabriel at dinner in King's, and then they worked together closely for a long period.
Yes.
Was it important in any...
Well, these occasions which have not really... they haven't remained in my mind, shall we say, as important events. One always does gain. Every time I go to college, I find I pick up something I didn't know about, usually not in my immediate field, but a sort of relevance to something else, which is very interesting.
How did you then switch from, or add on, shall we say, Magdalen as well as...
Right, that came out of the blue. I got a letter from a person not known to me, said saying that it, as I would know, which I didn't, was his job to appoint the mastership of Magdalen College, and he would value an opportunity to discuss this matter with me, which I took to mean that he had some candidates who he thought I knew the background or the lowdown. So I was invited out to Lord Braybrooke's.
Audley End,
very pleasant. We had a very nice lunch, talking about everything. Trains to skiing to holidays, and then suddenly he said, I thought, well, no, who is it? Who is he after? He wants me to tell him something. And then he suddenly said, well, now, oh yes, back to business. Now, what about it? So I said, how do you mean, what about what? He said, are you interested in the mastership? So I said, well, no, I haven't even considered the matter. I mean, how you know, can't just kind of say yes or no, just like that. So we sort of agreed. I said, well, I can't, you know, you can't say you want me to do it, or I can't say we need to think about it more and discuss it and reflect and talk to my colleagues and so on. So I said, well, could we agree that we think about it a bit more? So we went on like that, and then had a few more conversations, and then Magdalen asked me to go along there and be interviewed in an extremely mild and non-invasive way. My goodness, compared to what you hear on in other colleges, I should think yours must be prettier.
Pretty tough, yes.
Pretty useless business. It couldn't have been more benign. I mean, it was really unbelievably so. So in the course of time, then I was in the lab, I got a call from Lord Rowley saying, well, will you do the job? So by that time we thought it would be indeed nice to do it if I didn't have to give up my lab, which they said I didn't have to do.
When you say we, you
well, they're interested in my wife too.
Yes, I was going to ask about your marriage.
Yes, they asked her to come along too. That was very wise. She made a huge contribution to college, much more than I was able to do actually, and was very much appreciated for that. Mm. She really gave her whole time to managing the
college. What is her background?
She has no. She was did a little bit of nursing and then secretarial work and otherwise been a really extremely supportive wife, kind of looking after the children when I.
How many children have you got?
Two. Mm. But I was working extremely hard in my mid-career, long hours and weekends and evenings and things. So I was very lucky to have someone who could put up with that and keep the kind of domestic side running.
Mm. What is her name?
Her first name is Jean.
Jean. One, returning to the MRC, one of the incidents which I've heard many different accounts of is the mode of leaving of Fred Sanger after when he reached retirement age. I wondered if you had any memories of that event.
I have my own memory. I hope it's reasonably correct. And the occasion was that when Fred reached the time of his technical retirement on a Friday afternoon, a note came round saying there will be tea in the canteen 4 o'clock to mark Fred's retirement. So we were there in the canteen and Fred wasn't there. So we said, well, where's Fred? So someone said, oh, let's go and get him from his lab. So we went up to his lab and there was Fred with his pipetman sitting at his desk petting something into the Eppendorf tube, and someone said, Fred, it's your tea. So Fred, in his usual way, said, what's that? And they said, but Fred, it's your leaving party, it's your tea time. So Fred said, oh, put his pipetman down, his tube, went to tea, and went home afterwards. And that was the end.
To his famous garden. Tell me something about the transition from the MRC to the university proper.
So, as it were, out of the blue, I got this letter from the Vice-Chancellor saying that they would like to ask if I would accept the John Humphrey Plummer Professorship of whatever it was, previously held by Alan Hodgkin. And so I went to Max, as I usually do. Max,
and when was this? What
this would have been in 1982-ish or something like that.
Yeah.
The sort of natural inclination was, well, why do you give up an excellent job in a famous lab like MRC to take on teaching administration? So I said to Max, I've had this offer. He said, oh, I wouldn't accept that for a moment. You'll never do any science anymore, and all you do is sit on committees and waste your time in on trivia. But then I discovered that a very close colleague of mine called Ron Lasky, who was an early graduate student, and I've worked with him on and off all my life, a wonderful colleague, but he'd also been offered a job. This was a BA in zoology, another professorship. So I said to Ron, well, presumably you're not going to accept yours, are you? And Ron said, well, you know, let's just think about it. And we did think about it, and we noted that the positions that we'd inherited with the MRC unit that I came to the molecular biology lab with had essentially been whittled away, understandably, because no one else had positions. So we hadn't any staff positions anymore. So we said, well, if we could move into zoology and get a reasonable sized research grant, this would actually help a great deal. So we collectively decided, Ron Lasky and I decided we would move, and we said, you must give us time to try and get some funding, a research grant from the Cancer Campaign, as it was, and in course of time we did, and that turned out all to be due to Gabriel Horne. All
was
of this whole manoeuvre was I only discovered that later, entirely due to him, and a very clever manoeuvre by which he invited both of us to move into his department and gave us a floor in there, and we got the money and we moved in, and that was a very key event, because that meant we started with a sort of medium-sized research group
in the department, and we did our teaching, and that was very nice, in that lovely department under Gabriel. And then what happened was the work went rather well, and the Cancer Campaign, who sponsored us at that time, said, would you be interested in expanding a bit? So we said, well, that would be, says Ron Levski and I said, well, it would be nice. In an ideal world, we'd have a small institute. And they said, well, tell us about that. So we went along, and they said, well, what you're asking for is more than we can possibly, but we can't produce that much money. But we could give you, we could make a contribution to such a thing. And by good fortune, the Wellcome Trust came into money at that time. And we had an approach from them saying, would you be interested in having some work and support? So we said, could we put the two together? And so we did. We got the funding from the Wellcome Trust and the Cancer Campaign, and I most particularly emphasise the pivotal role that Gabriel Horn played in this, because we had this offer of money. It wasn't a huge amount, it was enough to build a small institute. And the many of what I call the barons would have been hostile to this, but why should you have a new kind of thing developing in the middle when everything was going on perfectly well as it was? But the Gabriel Horn was crucial in facilitating this. He actually thought it was a good idea and helped it along, and had a word with the chief secretary of the university, Ken Edwards, what are they technically called? Something
like Secretary General.
Secretary General, who then had the, no doubt due to Gabriel's advice, then said, well, what we'll do is we'll first ask the General Board whether this is a good idea. The General Board said, yes, we should accept this money, this is a good idea. And then they said, well, then we'll go down to the next one. And then we'll finally go to the heads of department, having, with all this information behind us. And that is really how it survived. So we got the money for our first edition of this institute, and Gabriel was the chairman of our advisory board, and immensely valuable. I mean, without him, I don't think it would ever have come into existence. So I really do want to emphasise that remarkable, very good of him, because it wasn't obviously helping his department. We are associated with zoology, but it wasn't going to immediately do a lot for it. But he could see the value of this from the university's point of view, and therefore very strongly supported it with some very clever manoeuvres to get rid of the objections. And then, of course, at the time, that went well, and we had an opportunity for bidding for a bigger operation, more money, and that time we got four million, and then we put together a proposal for this building, which actually cost 23 million, and amazingly got that. So going back, this really means that Gabriel Horn, having given the job to Ron Lasky and myself as two little groups, ended up becoming this fairly substantial sized institute. We're over 200 people now here, and bring in quite a lot of money for the university. So it was an interesting piece of history, against the advice of Max Perutz, who nevertheless remained a very good friend for all of his time, even though he wasn't in his institute anymore. But it does show what someone like Gabriel can do. Really does.
Tell me a little more about Gabriel. I mean, I know him well, and
yes,
like him very much.
So do I.
And he lives in the same village and so
on.
Road. What sort of person? You must have got to know him a bit.
I do feel I know him very well. Yes. Well, immense admiration for him. And not only that, but he's such a nice and interesting person, amazingly interesting in every possible way. And he really transformed that zoology department. You know, when he took it over, right, it was pretty bottom of the range. By the time he'd finished, I think he had 14 FRSs in his department. Quite amazing. And then he was a highly successful master of Sydney Sussex, in my view. So he's a kind of genius at managing things and people. And he's done this other thing, Cogpop, they call it, which is a very clever move. And
what was this other thing?
Well, I can't remember what it stands for, but it's a way of getting scientists together to advise the government. He must have talked about that in your...
Yes, he did.
He
got Richard Friend and people like this to go and talk.
That's
to
right, yes. And
did he get you to go?
Yes, I went along and participated in one of these, but it was a very clever manoeuvre to get the government to be interested in science, and that's a huge contribution. So he's he's a great person, really is.
And you must have known Prill, or you must know Prill as well,
yes.
Priscilla.
Yes, yes.
His charming wife.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, mm. Yeah, I know her too.
Yeah.
I always tease her because she has this lovely picture in zoology of her monkeys, yes, jumping from one tree to another. Mm. And I said to Prill, I didn't know monkeys always jump trees in groups of five. She said, no, there's one monkey. I said, Prill, I can count to five. There are five monkeys. And this is a sort of joke. She meant to show that the one monkey in different five phases of its jump, but me being an ordinary person can count to see there are five monkeys. So it's quite amusing.
And sweet. Returning again to Magdalen, it's not an easy thing to be a master of a Cambridge college because you have a lot of responsibility, or a certain amount of responsibility, and not very much power. Did you enjoy doing it?
Yes, I was very privileged and enormously lucky, I have to say, to end up with Magdalen. Mm. In Magdalen. I was interviewed, I should say, by a couple of other colleges, and in retrospect, thank heavens that didn't work. Mm. I wasn't chosen, thank heavens. Mm. But Magdalen was a wonderful college to belong to, fairly small, with a very highly experienced bursar, mm, who knew everybody, and I think the way things happened was that I joined there and very much wanted to sort of feel the way. Didn't some people, as you well know, come into a college, particularly from the outside world, and say, I must shake up this sleepy old place, they need to live in the real world, we'll get some things moving. Well, I didn't do that at all. And then the advice I was given, if you really want something to happen, you don't suggest it at all. You find someone else who suggested to someone else, and gradually a sort of feeling comes up that this might be quite a good idea. Mm. And then after a while you judge it will get through, so you ask for it to be considered by governing body. So I was probably seen as an extremely ineffective master, but nevertheless the college did well, mm, and it was a happy place. And I think you don't try and change something just because it changes. If it's working well, don't change it too much.
Mm.
So I was very grateful to them for letting me keep on my own lab work, which, mm, I did. So, mm, when the time came to stop, mm, I still have a lab to go to and I'm active again in my own field. And that was very generous of Magdalen to do that, mm, I think. So
do they have a president as well?
Yes, they do. The president is the senior fellow and a very important person.
Mm.
The president really, in many respects, the president is probably more powerful really than the master.
Mm.
The president can has the, he's sort of head of the governor of the fellowship.
Hmm.
Maybe the same for you, I don't know. That's
no, vice, there's a vice provost, but it's not quite the same.
Hmm. Hmm. President is a very important position.
Hmm.
I mean, in many ways, you're told you are really a servant of the, it is clear, you're a servant of the governing body, and the head of the governing body, in effect, is really the president, hmm, though you chair the meetings, but hmm. It's a wise manoeuvre, in my view, to go along with that situation. It makes for a happier college.
Mm. I mean, colleges are often criticised and equally often supported as a teaching institution, mm, as a place, mm, to encourage research. What is your feeling, I mean, about their value?
Yes, well, of course the teaching must be done, and it must be done well, but I personally took the view that we were very keen on every fellow having a significant research contribution, it worried me a great deal to see some of the younger fellows being asked to do terrible jobs like tutor for admissions.
Mm.
And we, in my time, we sort of survived without having to damage the careers of younger fellows. Mm. And now they've rather wisely split it a bit, so it's a little bit spread out.
Mm.
But it is a problem, I think, as to how you get these very tiresome jobs done without damaging the careers of younger people. So my view was we would like all of the fellows to have an important and successful research career, and if they can save time by handing on micro-administration to someone else, I would strongly encourage that.
Who do they hand it on to?
Well, they have secretaries, so that, mm, the admissions tutor will, mm, have a secretary. Now, a good secretary should take care of, in my view, all of the mundane stuff. And you need the fellow to take views on principles,
mm,
and explain the principle to the secretary type person or someone who would put it in practice. And I think there are colleges where
fellow concerned is expected to be much more the cold face, doing things themselves. I see the teaching as something which is very important, but I still think it's for a university like Cambridge, we're trying to compete with the rest of the world, we have to have people who are preeminent in their field. And you know, people at Harvard don't spend their time. Good example, some of my colleagues here spend time marking first year exam papers, you know, what is ATP or something like that.
I'm chairman of part one examiners next year.
Well, there you are, that's a big job. Well, I think someone who's got a sizable research group and competing all the time for grant money and getting maybe 15 people in his research group going around the world lecturing should not be asked to mark first year exam papers. I mean, I think someone else could do that, in my view. Now, this, yes. Of course, many people disagree, but that you ask what I think, and that is actually what I think.
I'll mention that to my department, quote you at them. Tell me about your current research. You've got this very big institute. We're always being told that we're on the verge of a breakthrough in cancer research and other things.
Yes, so this institute has always been one third cancer and two thirds what we call developmental biology. Developmental biology means how an egg develops into an animal, normal processes. Cancer is the opposite. When it ceases to become normal, it goes the wrong way. We've mixed the two. Historically, that's how we got our money, and it still works that way. So cancer, as you know, no one's going to solve cancer overnight. It's inconceivable. It's multiple different disorders, and it can only be analyzed by taking each particular cancerous condition and analysing step by step what goes wrong. And we're fortunate in having some very good groups in this institute who are working in aspects of cancer. And that's so that's they're highly regarded. I mean, I'm very delighted to say that in the last 2 years, each year we've had one of our what we call homebred staff members elected to the Royal Society. So these are people who joined us as a kind of senior postdoc, have developed their groups and now our FRS, and that's very satisfactory to see people thriving that well. One in the cancer side and the other one in the welcome side, the development biology side. So that's I would rather hope that we would take the view in a place like this that that is the career route we would ideally see for our appointments.
Is Michael Bate someone you know?
Yes, he's been a long-standing member of zoology.
He's a developmental biologist.
Yes, yes, that's right. He's chosen to stay in zoology. He's a very clever person.
I've interviewed him as well.
Did you?
Yes.
Very successful.
Very nice man.
Yes.
Just returning to that question, I mean, in either the two-thirds or the one-third, what would you pick out as the most exciting thing that is going on in this laboratory?
In this institute? Let me answer that by quoting the two people I've mentioned. One of them was elected Royal Society this year, called Stephen Jackson, appointed professor very young, and he's made real inroads into DNA repair. That all the time our genes are being damaged, and these are major causes of cancer, and he's been analysing meticulously, step by step, what goes wrong, with a view to trying to see if one can eventually alleviate the process of DNA damage by various chemicals which have favourable effects. And he started a company called Kudos, which saw the commercial side of this, and that was when he was a young person running a group. He also started his company. Now that was then sold for some huge sum of money recently, which I'm delighted to say. But when I was chairman here, I actually strongly encouraged this commercial side of things, because otherwise they're not well paid, these people, and I don't think if we said we don't want any commercial stuff going on, they'd have stayed. We'd have lost them all. So by encouraging the applied or commercial side of the work that goes on, I strongly believe that's what we should be doing. It's good for everything, for the country, the economy, for the individual,
University. Mm. So he's been very successful there. And another very successful younger person called Daniel St. Johnson, who works on the other side. He's on the developmental biology side, and he's analysing how it is that the components of an egg, in this case an insect egg, arise, because they form the basis of how the whole of the development occurs, how the whole of life progresses from there onwards. Egg is a kind of template, really, for the rest of life. Everything starts that way. And a very key question is, how does this amazing cell come to be possessed with these components in a way that enables it to start the next life? And he's been analysing that very successfully. So those are two good examples of younger people who've thrived happily in this environment and making very highly known internationally and made great success in their career. So I would give you those two examples of people who I think are doing preeminently interesting work.
It was interesting you touched on the links with the applications, the practical applications. Are these science park companies? I mean,
yes, the way it works is that if someone, Stephen Jackson and another one called Tony Kouzarides, both started companies.
How do you spell his name? Tony?
Kouzarides.
Kouzarides.
Another group leader on the senior group leader on the cancer side. And they both, the rules we have to operate, because we are charity funded, is that you can't do commercial work in a charitable organisation. So they have to have their company in the science park or somewhere separate. And they go across and act as a kind of advisor or guider. They guide the activity of both places. Both people have now sold their companies very successfully. Tony's one has, he really sponsored a company called Abcam, which is very successful in making antibodies, a good Cambridge company, that emerged out of someone from his group. He could see the commercial side of it, and but it has to be kept separate from us as a charity, otherwise we would lose our charitable status. But that works fine. No reason why you couldn't have a separate, as they do, separate groups, often quite large, working commercially, but not in this actual building. And it's good for the group leader, I would say, too, because they have benefit from it materially and in a way scientifically, too.
Some of the people I've talked to, like Andy Hopper, and I'm going to be interviewing Herman Hauser, not those two in particular, have expressed a concern that relations between these start-up companies and the university is always a very difficult one, because it's tempting for a university, particularly if it feels that it must raise more endowment and cash income to free it, to start putting too many bureaucratic hurdles and too much pressure on science innovations. Have you come across this problem at all?
Well, I have to say I perhaps haven't, but then Andy Hopper would know much more about that than me, and as indeed was Stephen Jackson and Tony Kouzarides. But both of these two have done extremely well. There may have been, I'm sure it's not entirely plain sailing when you're trying to balance these two things, but it must be the way, surely, forward for academics in university to have a significant commercial interest, if possible. Government would want this. It's good for the country because you develop business and you give employment to people. And so it surely must be exactly the right thing to do, and hope that the university doesn't prevent it happening, as they happened in these cases. You never know when you have a clever idea, if you ever do have one, whether it happened when you're at work or when you're sitting at home. But it's pointless to try and guess. But the fact is, these two have both been very successful and works well, and the university has certainly not interfered with it to an extent that has been at all damaging. So from my perspective, it's a very good way of doing things.
Well, there are many, many other things I'd love to have talked to you about, but I think that your lift is going to be coming quite soon. Is there just one other thing that, or anything else that I really should have asked you that you can...
Well, thank you. You've asked a very clever set of questions that touches on almost everything. I suppose one would particularly like to have made sure that I mentioned the people who have been instrumental in giving me what has really been an amazingly fortuitous career, ending up with in this nice new institute, contributing, I think, to the colleges, universities and everything. And I particularly mention Gabriel Horn, who I have mentioned. I would like to mention Ron Lasky, who was crucial in getting this whole institute going. He's now, he's a professor at the university, but he works in another institute up in the hospital. I think particularly those two I would want to mention as being particularly supportive for, not just for me, but really for the whole university of which they've been members all that time. And of course a great gratitude to Magdalen College and Churchill College, who have been extremely good to one. As I say, one feels a bit parasitic if one can contribute. I'm really, really privileged to have been have a career in a place like Cambridge. And of course Max Perutz for bringing me here.
Well, it's lovely to end like that, so thank you very much indeed, Johnny.
Thank you very much.